Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Will Arizona swing blue this election cycle? And what is the role of Hispanic voters over 50? The latest issue of Politico Magazine's new series, The Deciders, takes a deep dive in Maricopa County, Arizona, to understand the power of this unique voting bloc. Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, President Trump will bail out U.S. farmers who are on the sharp end of his escalating trade fights. But the move has some Republican lawmakers seeing red, as in Soviet red. We will explain all that and more as Trump's actions over the last couple weeks continue to anger a set of Republican senators, the big question being, what will they do about it? Plus, Trump has more fighting words for the media, and we're going to talk to our media reporter about whether the dynamic between the press and the president is shifting, and how this all relates into President Trump's broader political strategy for the midterms, for 2020, for how the White House wants to accomplish policy things, the whole smash. A reminder to our listeners before we get started with that to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review. And remember to stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome our guest. We have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian in the studio. Charlie, good to see you as always.
Hey, Scott.
And we've got on the line, we've got two of our intrepid congressional reporters. We've got Alana Shore on Skype from the Capitol. Hi, Alana.
Hi there.
And Burgess Everett, also on the Hill, is on the phone. Hi, Burgess.
Hey, Scott.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us. Time for our first data point, $12 billion. I think that's one of our largest data points yet. That's $12 billion the Trump administration has pledged in farm subsidies to offset the impact of his trade spats with China and U.S. allies. But, you know, this is really important. We've talked a lot in recent weeks about the impact that these trade issues have been having on Trump country, on farmers in particular. On the flip side, Trump's other big constituency, Republicans on Capitol Hill, are kind of freaking out about this. And we've seen a lot of big reactions from pro-free trade Republicans in the last few days. Right, Burgess?
Yeah. And you know, there's nearly a dozen, I would say, Republican senators who are just super gung-ho about this. And they're really just looking for any opportunity to at least sort of let Congress take back some of its authority on trade issues, which have sort of been ceded for the White House. And so, you know, we got this fantastic quote out of Ron Johnson from Wisconsin earlier this week about how $12 billion subsidies are evidence of a quote, Soviet-style economy. And what he's meaning by that is you're imposing taxes on farmers and others through these tariffs and the people that buy goods, and then what you're doing is paying them off so that they can wait until Trump is able to reach trade deals with our allies and some of our adversaries like China. So this market distortion is the kind of thing that Republicans would have killed President Obama for, and some of them are being very critical of President Trump as well.
And what are we hearing from ag groups and you know, the farmers who are actually affected on this, in addition to the senators who represent a lot of them?
Basically, what you're hearing is this aid is a positive because people are starting to feel the pinch from soybeans is probably the most common thing you'll hear about. Soybean prices have been dropping. And so this is something, this aid package is something that's going to help farmers weather this. But the counterpoint you'll hear is we don't want welfare. We just want to sell our products and work our farms and have a good year and export our goods to other countries that use them. So it's definitely sort of a temporary band-aid for the problems that the tariffs have created for these farmers.
And it's potentially doesn't necessarily cover the full extent of the problem that has been created, right? I think I've seen some of the reporting around this. There are, you know, it's obviously difficult to measure a lot of this in real time, but there's some suggestion that, you know, in terms of the economic pain that's already been suffered because of this, it exceeds the $12 billion that that is being earmarked here. And this is coming through the Department of Agriculture, right? This is not coming through Congress. So Congress can kick and scream about it, but there's nothing they can do about it in the meantime.
They wouldn't try to stop the payment because that would be absolutely terrible politics. But that doesn't mean they're not going to sort of criticize it. And you mentioned that there's a larger extent maybe than $12 billion on ag. That doesn't even bring in the manufacturing industries that are getting hit by the tariffs, the retaliatory tariffs on the United States right now.
That's a great point. Charlie, can you walk us through some of the political implications here? Again, I know we've talked about this a few times in recent weeks, but if you look at the places that are being most heavily affected by the tariffs, especially on the agricultural side, you start to outline a really sensitive map of you know, places throughout Iowa and elsewhere in the Midwest that maybe voted for Obama once or twice and then flipped to Trump in 2016, key battleground areas currently represented by endangered Republicans in Congress.
Yeah, soybeans is a great way to look at it, too. I mean, we talk about the $12 billion in subsidies, but there's a great story on our site today from Natasha Korecki, who was out in Iowa, who was talking to farmers about this. And, you know, what she discovered is that there's some 40,000 soybean farmers in Iowa alone. So ultimately, there's not that much money going to these farmers in subsidies, and certainly in many cases not going to be enough to mitigate all the damage that's done now, but also down the pike in the future. And look at the president's map today. Both the president and Mike Pence have done a great bit of damage control, whether they admit it or not, in the Midwest since the trade war started. Pence did a little Midwestern tour a week ago, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, doing some fundraisers and doing some events. And now Trump is essentially following the same track through Iowa and through Illinois. And if you take a look at the Iowa map, and you've got a couple of battleground competitive seats there, same is true in Illinois. Add them all up. There are six battleground House districts in Illinois and Iowa. And that is a quarter of the way to winning back the House for Democratic Party. So these kinds of seats are essential, and that's why the president is today going to Rod Blum's district in northeastern Iowa, and that's why he's in Dubuque, and why he'll go after that down to southern Illinois to Mike Bost's district. Very similar dynamics at play.
So, Alana, you've been doing some reporting on another issue that's really been animating Senate Republicans in a way that we don't often see, kind of against President Trump in recent weeks. You know, this week it's agriculture and these payments that free trade senators are talking about as kind of manipulating the economy. Last week it was Russia. And while it doesn't seem, at least not yet, like there's a lot of movement from senators to kind of wrest back trade authority to you know, maybe undo or mitigate some of these tariffs, there is some movement that you've reported on potential action on Russia. Can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of how it relates to you know, this bubbling sentiment within the Republican conference about the Trump administration right now?
Yes. Well, I think we're at a bit of a tipping point right now on Russia sanctions, where if there were a bill that there was a reasonable amount of consensus on in terms of, okay, these are new sanctions we can slap on Putin that won't hurt our allies, it might pass the Senate by an overwhelming margin, just like the sanctions bill passed last year. The problem right now is, number one, that bill doesn't exist yet. There are a couple of bipartisan options circulating, but none has necessarily picked up enough steam yet to be able to say that Mitch McConnell is under any real pressure to give it floor time. Because also remember, we're quite close to the election, and Mitch McConnell is no fan of Russia. He was no fan of that presidential press conference last week. But he's also not necessarily inclined to give Democrats a bipartisan win before the election by calling up a sanctions vote. So we've got this interesting tension now with a lot of appetite to do something, but not a lot of political reason for that something to happen.
How much of that appetite to do something is tied up in, you know, not only wanting to kind of punish Russia for any number of actions around the world, but to kind of send a little bit of a message to the president? Is that playing into this at all after having seen that press conference, I guess, a week and a half ago at this point?
I mean, potentially, but define message. You know, Senate Republicans
right.
also don't want to cause headlines, you know, we're slapping at the president. The most telling quote I got on this week was actually from Bob Menendez, the chief Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee and no ally of the GOP. I said, like, are you really believing you can get Republicans on this close to the election? Truly, Senator. And he said, you know, this isn't about hitting the president. It's about hitting Putin. And I think that's a canny decision from a liberal to talk about it that way, because that's the way he gets Republicans on board, not by making this about going to war with Trump.
That's a really interesting point. And Burgess, I mean that kind of fits into what we were talking with about trade, right? It's it seems to me like Republican Senate, they don't want to make this about fighting Trump. They want to make it about the policy, and they're kind of looking for excuses to not make it about Trump.
Well, it depends on which Republican senator you're talking about.
Tell us more.
if you're talking to Bob Corker or Jeff Flake, they might be doing this to get back at the president.
That is a great point.
If you're talking to Ron Johnson or Johnny Isaacson, they just simply don't like the policy.
I.e. the senators who are retiring versus the ones who are going to be around for a while.
Right. And then you could sprinkle in, a Ben Sasse who's not retiring this cycle, at least, and he's been very critical of the president on tariffs too. I would say that there is a faction of the Republican Party that thinks the president's out of control on the tariffs. There's another faction of the Republican Party who just doesn't like the policy and is very worried about the party drifting away from free trade. They've sort of united to form this bloc that wants to sort of tie the president's hands on tariffs. And yet there's another faction of Republicans, say, I think Joni Ernst of Iowa is one of the better examples, or you might look at someone like John Thune, who's in the leadership from South Dakota. These are people who really don't want to take on the president, and they are sort of, if something was going to happen in the Senate on trade, these would be the folks who would have to vote for it to put it over the 60-vote threshold. And so when you have the president sort of announce an agreement to make an agreement with the EU on soybeans yesterday, people like Joni Ernst were very excited about it. And so if the president's able to hold people like that away from legislation that might tie his hands, I don't think you'd see any action in the Senate because of that point that you just brought up. Most Republicans do not want these headlines about them taking on President Trump.
Alana, I want to give you the last word here. What should we look out for? You know, you gave us kind of these guideposts about the some of the decisions and obstacles to potential action on Russia sanctions. What's next up in terms of what you're watching for and kind of timeline for potential action? Obviously, like you mentioned, with the election kind of looming in everyone's view.
Yeah, I have to believe that it'll take one more, straw on the proverbial camel's back to really force something to happen. And that might be a date for the Trump-Putin summit next year. That might be an actual sanctions-related policy move that the administration will announce. But if the administration can manage to say nothing, like stay totally quiet about coziness towards Moscow between now and the election, it's pretty possible this just fades. However, the chances of that are kind of low, given their past record. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, and again, I just think that this relates into this kind of pattern relates back into everything we see with the Trump administration and Senate Republicans and House Republicans. It's that something happens and there's kind of this burst of outrage and this kind of burst of momentum or potential momentum towards something, and then it fades and people get distracted a little bit by something else that goes on, and there's the election coming up and there's this and there's that, and then it. Sometimes something happens, sometimes something doesn't. And then, 2 months later, something else happens again. Like you said, the White House is not a particularly controlled entity. And then the cycle starts over again. So,
it's certainly the follow the bouncing ball, the shiny thing presidency. So we will see if Russia is that shiny thing for too much longer.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Charlie, I know you're going to stay put for segment two, but we're going to say goodbye for now to Burgess Everett. Burgess, thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
And Alana joining us on Skype. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are going to jump right into our next segment, but first we're going to take a quick break for a word from a sponsor.
Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Democrats have been expecting Barry Goldwater's home state of Arizona to flip blue for years, yet it remains red. Will 2018 be the election cycle that tips the scales? The latest issue of Politico Magazine's new series, The Deciders, takes a deep dive into Maricopa County, Arizona, to understand the power of Hispanic voters over 50. With two crucial Arizona races in play, will it be voter turnout in this group or identity politics that decides the day? Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more.
All right, we are going to move on to our next data point, which is three quarters of Republicans trust Trump over the media to tell the truth about important issues. That's according to a new poll from Quinnipiac University out this week. And we're going to talk a little bit about the tension between the media and the White House in our next segment. Not so much from our perspective as journalists, because I feel like probably everyone listening to this has to deal with difficult people at their work. But in terms of how this plays into the Trump administration's broader plans and goals. So here in the studio to talk about it, we have White House correspondent Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And joining us for his Nerdcast debut, we have Jason Schwartz, who is Politico's media reporter. Hi, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Jason, you had a really interesting story today about how the Pentagon has become kind of behind the scenes a little bit, another battleground in this kind of long simmering conflict between the Trump administration and the media. Can you tell us a little bit about your most recent reporting?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. The very short version is that reporters in the Pentagon press corps are increasingly feeling like they're not getting enough information to inform the public about what the American military is doing. Which is sort of a remarkable thing when you think about it. Secretary of Defense Mattis has not briefed on camera since April. His top spokesman hasn't done so since May. Reporters find that, you know, officials who used to talk to them all the time all of a sudden, you know, are zipped up. And, you know, it's just less information flow making their way. Fewer reporters even going to the Pentagon. It's just not worth their time anymore, they say.
Is this in response to anything in particular, or is this kind of happening?
It's gotten worse over the last few months, but I think the short version is it's in response to Trump. The Secretary Mattis has worked pretty hard to keep a low profile, keep out of the spotlight, not be on cable TV is really the big one. And the other part of that is that, you know, they might not always know what the White House is going to do over in the Pentagon, so they're afraid to say anything that's going to get them crossed up.
That's a really good point. We've seen that a number of times, right, Nancy?
Yeah, we have. Like, just one example that I always come back to is the transgender ban, which the president announced over Twitter against the wishes of Mattis and a bunch of military officials and against the wishes of his lawyers. You know, they kept telling him to slow walk it, they need to study it, and he just got tired of it, so he announced it. And so I do feel like, you know, Mattis is in a bit of a precarious position. He's aligned himself with General Kelly, who's a bit marginalized these days. And so it makes sense to me that he's laying low. I do think by like restricting press access so much, you know, you cause a reaction in and of itself, and that draws more attention to it. But just one more thing on that, you know, this just fits into a much broader pattern that we've seen in the last year of just decreasing transparency from the White House. So, you know, they don't release the visitor logs to the White House. That's been a really big blow to seeing who goes in and out. This week, they stopped releasing readouts of calls that the president has with foreign leaders. Now, like, those readouts are never particularly detailed, but they do at least alert the press that he has called the president of Turkey or, you know, Macron in France. And now we sort of have no sense of that. And then they also lately, just because they've been under such fire for a bunch of different things like the Michael Cohen stuff, the separating migrants and families, they've really decreased the number of briefings that they've had.
And this is all against the backdrop, Charlie, of Trump telling folks at a speech in Kansas City, quote, "Just remember what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening," which is an amazing, incredible blanket statement to make about the reporting on what's going on in his administration and what the policies that his administration has enacted are doing.
Right, but that's no surprise. You know, I mean, the media bashing is just catnip for him, and it's
no surprise, but it's crazy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he's been doing it since the beginning, and it has produced tremendous dividends to him. I mean, it's a stock part of every rally, it's every appearance he makes, it's part of his brand, and I mean, it's political gold for him. I mean, he spins political gold every time he hits the media. There is no constituency that vote. I mean, nobody wins votes by embracing the media. Nobody, not at all. But you can win a lot of votes by beating the heck out of the media, and he has realized that, and he's tapped into a lot of animosity toward the media, and he will continue to do it, and it will be a huge theme in his reelection campaign as well.
It's not just even the media, though. I feel like by him saying, you know, don't believe what you're hearing or seeing is also a knock against, you know, the intelligence community that is saying there was Russian interference in the election, which he has sort of disagreed with. Like, it's just sort of undermining the media, intelligence community, agencies, like anyone who sort of publicly disagrees with him. And I think it's really laying the groundwork so that when much more serious political things happen, like the results of the Mueller investigation, for instance, you know, he is in a position to have so undermined those institutions, including the media, that, you know, a bunch of people, including his base, won't believe whatever comes out.
You know, I was also struck listening to interviews with farmers, other people who had been hurt by the trade tariffs, saying, you know, these people who had supported Trump in the first place saying, yeah, you know, I've lost some money, I'm in a hard shape, but I trust them, you know, I think this is going to work out. And it sort of gets at the same thing, like, trust me, I'm the one who's going to take care of this for you. Don't believe all this other stuff. So it goes deeper than the media in some ways, it feels like.
So, Jason, how are you, as you report on the media in Washington and elsewhere, what are you seeing happening in response to this? I think we're seeing some behavioral changes in the way the media reacts to the barriers that the White House and others are erecting in their way, not just in terms of, you know, the relentless news cycle, I mean, and the kind of relentless reporting on it, but some tactical things and like very, very kind of nitty gritty things, and just in terms of trying to find out information.
Yeah, it does seem like journalists are sort of banding together a little bit. I think it got a lot of attention. It was either last week or the week before. It's time is sort of a blender now. I don't even know. where Jordan Fabian from The Hill, in a press briefing at the White House when Hallie Jackson was trying to finish a question and Sarah Sanders was cutting her off, Jordan sent it back to her, basically said, you know, finish this question. That was something a lot of people noticed as sort of a sign of like, okay, you know, the White House press corps is in this together. Whether that's like a one-time thing or going to be more of a trend, we'll see. But certainly you saw a lot, you know, after Caitlin Collins from CNN, after she was not allowed into the event at the Rose Garden yesterday, you saw a lot of reporters speaking out in support of her, Fox News reporters as well. So it does seem like, at least for now, Nancy can probably speak to this better than I can, that there's some sense of pull together.
Charlie, when you talk about the political upside for Trump doing this, do you mean upside in terms of broader appeal, or are you just talking about Trump's seemingly constant efforts to make sure that core of his base, however much it is, stays tight?
I think it's about animating the base, but it's also a no-lose situation. You don't lose any voters, or at least Trump is not going to lose any voters, and he's not going to lose any Republican voters from bashing the media. I mean, Republicans have long had an issue with what they believe is a profound and enduring media bias. And so that has really been something that has gotten under their skin for many, many years, long before Donald Trump. But I think Trump has really concentrated that animus, and it really drives his base. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what struck me the first time I got out on the trail and started in 2016 and attended a couple of Trump events, is how animated folks got when he talked about the media, when he bashed them, and how angry they got. And I think he knows it's political gold for him. That's why he talks about it so much and why it's integral to his political brand.
I mean, Nancy, another person who knows the political value of this sort of thing is the new White House communications director, right? Who is, in his previous role at Fox News, helped foment the distrust of a lot of other media among conservatives leading up to this point. Can you tell us a little bit about Bill Shine and what he's been up to in his first weeks at the White House?
Yeah, and I also think it's important to note that he was in a number of lawsuits named as someone who was very integral at Fox News of covering up all of the sexual harassment of Roger Ailes, and that is part of why he left Fox News. And so anyway, now he's taken up this job in the White House. You know, he's very close to Sean Hannity, who is very close to President Trump, and he's taken on this. He's the Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications. I haven't interacted with him personally myself. I did think it was interesting that, you know, one of his first public moves was to bar a young female reporter from attending a public White House event. I feel like, given his sort of baggage at Fox, covering up sexual harassment things, I think that, you know, that reeks a little bit of a misogyny to me, to bar a young female reporter, or just sort of a bullying move. But that's always something that, you know, White House communications directors do. But I do think that he has accumulated power pretty quickly, and I think that he's someone to watch in the White House. There was a really interesting tidbit in a Gabe Sherman piece for Vanity Fair, which I haven't I haven't sort of asked anyone about yet. I haven't had time, but apparently Bill Shine is also, in addition to overseeing communications, overseeing personnel at the White House, which will be a huge portfolio because so many people have left. They have to do a lot of hiring. And so I think it will be really interesting to see sort of how he plays, you know, as a former big television producer, sort of how he plays to the president's instincts on that. And also just sort of how his role continues to grow because he is reporting directly to the president and sort of how that relationship continues will be something important to watch through the rest of the year.
And I think every once in a while it's worth to sort of pull back and just sort of think about, to Nancy's point, Bill Shine, based on the way he left Fox News, the circumstances he left under, is a guy who probably couldn't get a job at almost any big company in this country. He just couldn't get hired because of his HR record, and he's in the White House now. So, you know, and to bring it full circle, the reason they're able to do that is because when the media writes about this and when, you know, there have been lots of columns about this, people jumping up and down screaming about it, the president's supporters, they go, you know, it's the media. So it really sort of comes around that way.
I'm curious to see what, if any, effect that he seems to have on this seemingly somehow worsening relations between the White House and the press, and how that continues to play into, you know, President Trump's political strategies. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. That was excellent.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Was it as exciting as you thought?
I was a little worried I was going to get like stuffed in a locker, maybe some swirlies, but I think I came out okay.
The studio is a little bigger than a locker, but not too much. We're very, very happy you could join us today. Nancy, great to see you as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Charlie, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, as promised, before we head out this week, we are going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan. Stephen Fay of Sydney, Australia, is going to help us out with the credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer and the illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and are listening to Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Stephen. Listeners, we found Stephen because he emailed to say he was a fan of the Nerdcast. If you are a fan of the podcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. One last note before we go. Our colleague Dan Diamond talked this week with Sylvia Matthews Burwell, the former Health and Human Services Secretary under the Obama administration. It's a great conversation that touches on the border crisis, the Trump administration's efforts to tear down the Affordable Care Act, and a lot more. So please check it out, one of our sister podcasts. It's the Politico Pulse Check podcast. Go ahead and search for it right now. You won't regret it. Thank you so much again for listening this week. We will talk to you again next week.